Once Upon a Future Past. If I don't put this down on paper, I will go out of my mind. Faced with facts and rational logic on one hand, and what I have seen with my own eyes on the other, I find that they form an alliance that gives me a splitting headache. I've gone over it all time and time and time again. Now there's a funny word, time. That's the root of the trouble, and I've tried to explain it to my mother and my psychiatrist. Neither of them believe a word of it. My mother tries to look concerned, but all she'll do is tell me that sometimes people think she's crazy, too. At least my shrink has the decency to act like he's struggling to understand. 75 an hour will do that. I met Dr. Professor Merlin Ambrose Magruder several years ago. I say Dr. Professor because he was known differently to different people. For some, he insisted on the doctor moniker. Others were allowed to call him Professor. I was the only living soul on his third list. I called him Doc. Doc Magruder was my savior in graduate school. Advanced electrical engineering was my life, and I had a propensity toward it in a physical way. But the academic work was nearly beyond me. I just didn't test well and worked poorly under pressure. I never wanted to build H-bombs or work in the high-stakes world. There's plenty of engineering work for people like me out there just beyond the rat race, and it was the quiet world to which I aspired. Doc was my primary thesis advisor during that final year at the University of Calgary, and he was my closest friend. When things got tough, I sought solace in Doc's lab and worked with him long into the night. He was absorbed in a major grant project of some sort, and cheerfully accepted my help with the tedious task of wiring connectors and writing unusual software. Since unusual system software was the heart of my graduate project, I jumped at the chance. Doc's lab was always quiet and very, very low-key. He wasn't married and seemed to have all the time in the world. We passed many nights not in equipment assembly, but in long chats about literature and the state of humankind over very sweet, hot tea. Doc shared my love of British mythology as well. I have always believed Arthur, King of the Britons, to be an amalgam, like Jesus, a mixture of many famous people of the dim, poorly recorded past, all rolled into one spectacular person. Doc, on the other hand, was adamant in his defense of the actual human being. To him, Arthur was real, the Round Table was real, and all the knights of old were once living and breathing the British air. We fought over Geoffrey of Monmouth's text, History of the Kings of Britain, much as biblical scholars fight over the Bible in a contest of discourse. It was great fun, and we both knew more about it all than the faculty on campus to whom the duty of actually teaching it was relegated. I stopped at the library on my way to work once, expecting to pick up a copy of Malory's Mort d'Arthur, but was disappointed to find it checked out. I admit that I wasn't the least bit surprised to find it next to the teapot in the lab. Doc was amused. The lab schedule was tough. He set his calendar, and even though beset by difficulties and failures, he managed to keep us on schedule. Even though every hour in the lab was technically work, I always left in higher spirits than when I arrived. Doc was, without a doubt, my closest friend. After I graduated, I opened a small engineering company. I had my fresh connections with the university and was convinced they would supply me with enough work to get me on my feet. Advanced Systems Design Company of Calgary, Alberta, was born. Almost at once, I found the wolf at ASD's door. It wasn't working out at all well. That's when Doc stepped in, and that's where this story actually begins. Doc had been working on pet projects and high-energy microphysics for as long as I had known him. His particle wave beam research came to be known on campus as the Phaser Project, and Doc took a lot of good-natured ribbing concerning his unintended Star Trek connections. I knew he was heavily into the theories of particle physics at or near the speed of light, but I never quite understood where he intended to take it. Pure research for pure research's sake, I supposed. 6 years ago, as my academic world ended and the scary world of supporting myself with ASD began, Doc landed his biggest grant yet. One of the first things he did was to hire ASD, me, as his personal engineering company. Doc was a lifesaver. I understood that Doc was, once again, watching out for me. But I also realized, right from the beginning, that he wanted to keep his research quiet and discreet. Well, discreet I could be. Doc's grant came from the Canadian Science Foundation and involved the temporal characteristics of tachyon particles. Tachyons were, as yet, undefined. Physicists know they exist and can see their effects, yet the particles defied all scientific efforts to catch one, so to speak. They, if they exist at all, have the unique characteristic of having no mass and traveling apparently at infinite speed, infinitely faster than light. Science fiction writers have long used them as the vehicle to give their story characters the ability to communicate across the galaxy without the pesky delays of light speed. Those same writers figured the tachyons are the key to warping space and time. Writers, what are you going to do? But in reality, tachyons do exhibit some strange characteristics. They do seem to be able, if they exist at all, to go faster than the speed of light. Einstein would have loved them. If the theory of relativity is true, then tachyons are the key to temporal manipulation. Time travel. Anyway, that was the focus of Doc's research, and I spent 5 long and very profitable years locked up with him in his lab. As I would finish writing a program, he would give me the specs for a circuit that he needed constructed. When I would finish that, he would move me to yet another small part of the larger whole. Yet I never felt the clock breathing down on me, and we always had time for a quiet cup of tea and an Arthur fight. We talked of worldly things and personal things. Finally, 2 years ago, he began to speak of the fine points of the project itself. I'm not going to bore you. The details are of no consequence when the big picture is so, how will I put it, unbelievable. No, unbelievable just doesn't do it. Doc has, or maybe had is a better way to put it, a crazy idea. I think his peers would have transposed crazy with insane. The essence of his project was to concentrate a series of wave motions upon a stream of tachyons. He was so matter-of-fact about it when he told me, it was like he didn't even consider the possibility that I wouldn't believe him. He thought that if the demonstrations of temporal displacement and tachyon particle beams were accurate observations of actual time shifts, he could expand upon it. Reverse temporal stutter was how he referred to it. Think about it, my boy, his voice would rise. Go back and dabble in the recent past? Hell with the paradoxes. Make some money on the stock market. Play the lottery. Maybe just screw with the fabric of what should have been, eh? Doc was starting to worry me, but time travel? Come on now. But as long as he was in the grant, I was in the grant. The ASD company and my way of life had gotten used to paid bills and full refrigerators. I got to the point where I dreaded our little late-night chats. The tea was still good, but the company was starting to scare me a bit. The first earthquake in my personal universe happened about a year ago. Doc was ready to start testing under power, and the whole look of the lab had changed. All our efforts were starting to coalesce in the center of the vaguely circular room. A raised platform sat in the middle of several open maws. Mouths of particle generators and accelerators and lasers and lethal magnetic fields and God knows what else. It was more than a little spooky. My involvement had changed so slowly over the years that as the systems were gradually constructed and as the software took shape, I found myself more of a lab assistant than an external contractor, and an air of familiarity made everything seem so typical. But now the subtle things, like the low hum of normally dormant transformers, the bright lights at the focal point, and the vibrations I felt through my shoes made the lab take on a sinister and menacing look. Knowing that Doc was about to bring the systems to life and begin testing things at full power, a new awareness began to seep into my mind. The lab suddenly took on an alien look that I didn't find at all comfortable. Doc wanted one last cup of tea before he began to power up for the first test. He pulled our 2 favorite chairs onto the platform and placed a little tea cart between them. He poured our tea and handed me the Calgary Sun, today's edition. Look at the article on page 3, the pawn shop, he said without looking at me. And what time do you have, young man? High in the center column on page 3 was a story about a break-in at the Laramie Jewelry and Pawn on Coker Avenue. Thieves had broken into the store the night before around 11:30 and stolen over 50 guns, 2 display cases of jewelry, and a great deal of cash. Angry owner, no suspects. Nothing unusual about any of it. They were burglarized every year or so. And it was about 10 p.m. right now, I told him. But Doc wasn't finished. He had me photocopy the page from the paper and place the original in my own briefcase and lock it and place the folded copy in my shirt pocket. He reminded me that it was my briefcase and my combination. Next, he had me open the lab safe and reprogram the combination to anything I wanted. I placed the locked briefcase inside, closed the safe door, and spun the tumbler. For the combination, I had picked JFK's birthday. Left 5, right 29, left 17. The exercise had taken on the flavor of a magic trick. He asked me to sit down and finish my tea. What happened next is a mystery. I can only remember waking up on the platform next to my chair with the worst headache I've had in years. Doc was cradling my head in his lap and wiping my forehead with a wet towel. I drifted in and out. I remember vomiting a time or two, and Doc was really upset. He kept saying he was sorry, but he had to do things this way or I wouldn't be safe or believe. I'm really not sure who said what for the next couple of hours. After I got my legs back, Doc asked me to retrieve my locked briefcase from the safe. As soon as I stood up, I nearly heaved again, but managed to go out into the lab where the safe was. I nearly didn't get it open. I almost forgot the new combination. JFK who? With the briefcase tucked under my arm, I came back to the platform and sat down next to Doc. He was really agitated and grinning like a little boy with a secret. I stared at the front page for a time, not really focusing on anything and trying to remember what the paper was all about. Page 3, page 3. Doc's legs were bouncing up and down like he had to pee. I turned to page 3 and started to scan it quickly. There was a story about a public meeting concerning the Queens Parkway extension, various assorted store ads, and a column about a new grant for the library. I just didn't make any sense out of the magic trick, and my sudden illness was keeping me from focusing on anything in particular. Until I looked clear down near the bottom of the page, on the right. Vandals hit Laramie Pawn. What the hell? The story described an incident of vandalism, wherein the store's front window had been broken at 10:30 p.m. by a brick. The alarm summoned the police, and the owner had to board up the window. No burglary, no jewelry gone, no guns taken, no cash missing, just a pissed-off owner. A cold chill swept across my face as my blood pressure dropped like a stone. I snatched the photocopy out of my shirt pocket and unfolded it, looking at the two pages side by side. There it was on my copy, the story of burglary and stolen merchandise. In fact, the two sheets bore no common material at all. I looked up at Doc. Hefting a brick in one hand, he said, "Took two in case the first one didn't work." My head began to swim again. Doc took this as a cue to start talking. It didn't stop until he had told me everything. The bubble. He called it a bubble. I had no idea what that was all about until the next night, but I don't want to get ahead of myself here. He said the bubble causes a virtual, temporal, folded perspective shift to anything or anyone within it. Well, in Earth talk, things inside the bubble shift in time. The best way to prove he had actually gone back in time was to take someone with him to share in a clear memory of the way things were before. But since I would panic, he was right on the money there. He had to, as he said, render me pliable. Chloral hydrate in the tea was the best thing he could think of. Jeez, Mickey Spillane knockout drops. He only had to use a drop or two. He thought he may have used a teaspoonful. If I hadn't loved him so much, I'd have punched his lights out right then and there. Anyway, he said we rode the bubble back, with me unconscious. He tossed the brick through the pawn shop window a half hour before the burglars would arrive and beat a hasty retreat. Or is that an advance? I guess that's it. He beat a hasty advance. Lord, this is all so confusing. Well, I rode the bubble with him, so both of us retained our memory, even though I was completely oblivious to what was happening at the time. However, the newspaper, the burglars, the lab, my psychiatrist, my cat, and everything else in this temporal universe outside of the bubble changed. It wouldn't do any good to tell anyone else. Doc and I were the only living souls who knew what should have been, what used to was. I made the mistake of asking how time travel was linked to the physical movement of things not likewise traveling. You know, if the bubble moves back a day, how can it come to rest in a place where the Earth wasn't? I mean, if you move back in time, wouldn't the bubble come to rest in a place where the Earth has moved away from? What keeps it from going back 600 years and reappearing in free space, 20 light years away from where the Earth is? Now this is where I have to rely on rote memory to tell you how Doc explained it. I heard him say the words, but I didn't actually grasp it all. As best as I can remember, the temporal bubble is fixed in space-time by the gravitational constants that surround it at the moment it formed. By making the temporal shifts in millisecond bursts, the bubble is never far from the gravitational locus where it had been a millisecond before. I believe he called it specific gravitational recentering, or something like that. He threw a Coke can across the lab. Every time it hits the floor, it damn well knows where it is, doesn't it? But when it's in the air, where does it think it is, my boy? It doesn't know. No point of reference. Besides, it's a Coke can. How smart can a can be? I made some vain effort to interject a "well, I" or a "yeah, but." It was pointless. Doc knew what he was talking about. I didn't. He thought I did. I still didn't. His explanation left my head spinning after his quantum mechanics and temporal philosophy stream of consciousness. My head hurt, but I got the point that controlled time and space travel were both simultaneously possible, so long as the traveler makes bathroom breaks every 1.3 milliseconds. Holding my temples between my hands, I had almost forgotten that I didn't believe a word of it. Even staring the facts and evidence in the face, I kept looking for some kind of explanation for all of it. Really, I kept waiting to wake up in my own warm little bed. Doc sent me home and told me not to come back for a few days. He had things to do and would have the lab locked. He'd call me. I took the newspaper and went home. I must have read and reread that newspaper 100 times over the next few days. I tried to remember what else was in it before I put it into the safe, but I just hadn't been paying any attention to things social, and excepting for the pawn shop story, it sure seemed the same to me. I even went to the library to check their copy. No revelation. Theirs was the same as mine. I really wasn't surprised. My headaches returned, but it wasn't from the chloral hydrate. I just couldn't take it all in. I believed Doc. I saw the paper change. I don't believe in time travel. I locked the safe. I trust Doc. Doc knocked me out. Time appears to have changed. No wonder my head hurts. Doc called me again about a week later and asked me to come to the lab. He was ready for another test and wanted someone he could trust to witness and help. He must have apologized 6 times for the knockout drops. He was genuinely upset that he had done that to me and promised no funny business this time. And so I went. The lab was the same as I had left it, with one exception. Doc had all manner of material stacked up on the platform in the focal point of the room. Centered among it all were our 2 chairs, radio gear, CD player, solar panels, large NiCad rechargeable batteries, freeze-dried rations, lasers, opticals, 2 computers, printer, hiking boots, 2 suitcases, today's Wall Street Journal and the Sun-Times, and disturbingly, a shotgun and a .45 automatic. He had also moved the filing cabinets with all the project's documentation onto the platform. Doc came right up and started talking like he hadn't ever stopped. "If you could go back in time, where would you go?" he asked. Hell, I wasn't up for the sci-fi hour. I had just about convinced myself that there was indeed a rational explanation for all of it. "I really hadn't thought about it," I told him. He talked of paradoxes and temporal censorship and all kinds of other Art Bell wisdom. "I know that if I go back and murder my father, I would not have existed at all, and since I do exist, there's the paradox. Philosophers and scientists all decry the theoretical use of time travel. They all agree on the evil of such an endeavor, but they only say that because they can't do it." Doc was shouting. His diatribe went on and on. "Paradoxes are a potential danger, so what the hell? Avoid them. Don't kill my father. Don't have a conversation with myself at 6 years old. Don't marry my own mother. That seems simple enough, doesn't it? Besides, how in the world can that be profitable?" It seemed that Doc had only one thing in mind. Money. Apparently his plan was to go back a couple of decades and quietly buy a few stocks, bet on a pony or two, or maybe play the first big lottery. The technology from 20 years distant would certainly come in handy, yet wouldn't look too out of place to the casual glance. Make some big money, come home with a few thousand shares of that unknown upstart technology company, Microsoft, or something along those lines. He wanted me to come along, awake this time, to bear witness, and maybe, if I could loosen up my scruples just a bit, make some serious money, too. I just didn't know what to think. Maybe Doc had gone crazy. Maybe I was crazy. Maybe it was a dream. One of those dreams that plays out over a week. It actually happens just after the snooze alarm goes off. No, crazy is a better bet. Anyway, the lab was fired up, Doc was fired up, and damned if I wasn't getting fired up as well. Okay, if this is insanity, let's have some fun with it. Doc had everything tucked in real close to the center area of the platform, just enough room for our chairs. He spent some time pulling this box in closer, stacking those little boxes on top of those big boxes, and trying to make everything take up as little room as possible. We sat down in our chairs. I wouldn't have noticed the new additions to them, but Doc pulled up a seat belt and buckled it. I also saw that our chairs had been bolted down to the floor. I snapped my belt on and didn't even entertain the notion of asking why. Doc poured the tea. I looked into my cup, half wondering what was in it this time. Doc chuckled softly and traded cups. No fooling now, my boy. You need to ride the bubble awake this time. No matter what you see, trust me, stay in your chair. You're going to love this. In the whole world, throughout all time and in all places of the universe, known and unknown, there has never been a larger understatement. The generators started their upward pitch, and before I could put my teacup down, we were surrounded by a translucent bubble of swirling neon glow, and my shirt front took the full impact of my tepid tea. The colors danced and swirled and cycled and played themselves out on the thinnest of soap bubble membranes wrapped around the platform. Through the ionization, I could make out the lab, but there was a perspective shift, as if looking through an aquarium. The lab disappeared, and the colors grew so bright they hurt my eyes, yet my pupils remained dilated, and my eyes were open wide. I heard voices, saw voices, shimmering glass voices speaking from just beyond my perception. Doc seemed taller, shorter, thinner, fatter. Nothing would remain focused or centered. As I turned, things just beyond my field of vision remained so, as if actively avoiding my notice. I'd taken a lot of LSD in my post-high school days. I'd seen the wallpaper bleed, and I heard voices from inside my head, but nothing, I mean nothing, could have prepared me for what was happening now. As quickly as it started, it stopped. The bubble popped. Actually, the bubble banged, and my ears roared. It was pitch black beyond, the kind of black that soaks up light. I felt everything being pulled toward it like some great hungry nothingness. Then the bubble began to reform right where it had been a moment earlier. There was the faintest sheen to the bubble edge, and soft, nearly invisible colors were running around its surface. Then an image began to form beyond. I was dumbstruck. What lay before me was clear countryside. Grass, trees, cows, birds, clouds, bees, all of it. Yet like a soft video dissolved through the quiet colored bubble, I could still make out the faintest image of the lab, everything in normal perspective. I just sat there, suddenly aware that I hadn't taken a breath in quite some time. "Well, my boy?" Doc was on his feet near the surface of the bubble, looking out into the countryside. He extended his hand and gently touched the colored surface. Music came from his fingertips, and the static voices moved back and forth in my head. Where are we? I asked, barely controlling a shiver. Dunno. Doc's voice trailed off. He was staring at the colors as they swirled about his fingertips. He was clearly not in complete control of himself either. That is when I started paying attention to the image of the lab. It had grown brighter, more defined, clearer. I saw the racks of equipment. I saw the shine of ionized air around the mouths of the tachyon generators, and I saw the fire. Back in the rear of the lab, near the power generators, a small fire was becoming a big fire, and the countryside was beginning to move about. What happened next only took a moment, just a second, yet it seemed to be playing out in slow motion. It was like looking down the inside of a slinky. The back of the lab started to rotate clockwise. As it turned, things closer in began to turn as well, and with each moment the twisting lab came closer to me. I just didn't have time to do anything, no time to yell, no time to warn Doc. Yet, as fast as the twisting image was approaching me, I seemed to have plenty of time to piss my pants. Playing out in dream time, this was happening fast, that was happening slow, Doc seemed not to be happening at all. Then the rotation in the lab finally came right up to the edge of the platform, and the bubble spun about like a carnival ride, nearly rupturing my spleen against the shoulder belt. In fast, slow motion, all our cargo, all the newspapers, all the boxes and filing cabinets were flung outside of the bubble. Something struck me from behind, and when I raised my head, everything that wasn't bolted down was gone. The bubble and the countryside were gone as well. And so was Doc. I was sitting in my chair with half my jeans burned away and pain along every surface of my body. The lab was a wreck and definitely on fire. I managed to unlock my seatbelt and crawl to safety and was quickly intercepted by paramedics. They had received the fire alarm nearly an hour before, and the fire department had only just broken through the impenetrable lab door. I have no idea how long I was in the bubble, or even how long the bubble was actually in the lab. It seemed to be only 1, maybe 2 minutes. But I had no clear idea of the passage of time. My tea-soaked shirt and piss-soaked pants had protected me to some degree, but my watch was gone, revealing a third-degree burn on my wrist. I may have discovered, or perhaps invented, the paradox burn. Great, but who in this world can I tell? That was over a year ago. Up until a few days ago, I was beginning to accept Dr. Merlin Ambrose Magruder's disappearance. The lab was a mess, and no body was ever found. His death was recorded as accidental, and the circumstances surrounding his missing corpse were never settled. Foul play was never seriously pursued. The best guess is that the primary explosion and high-voltage arcing vaporized the flesh. The fact that no blood or tissue, even in the smallest degree, was ever found complicated matters. But if you don't have an answer, you don't have an answer. I am unwilling to mention all the cargo that should have been strewn about the destroyed lab. None of it was. I missed Doc terribly and have wondered about him each and every day. I had never expected the detectives to tell me they solved the case, and I knew in my heart they would never find a body. His disappearance had most surely involved temporal displacement, though I hadn't even begun to wonder how or where or when. But 2 days ago, I had a revelation of the most unsettling sort. I have missed our long into-the-night discussions of British mythology very much. I was having some tea, and I plucked Doc's personal copy, most probably the university's copy, of Mort d'Arthur from his reverent place on my bookshelf. Trying yet another avenue in my quest to come to terms with the hole his disappearance has made in my life. The book, which I have come to know almost by heart, had changed. Subtle differences in text and flow were more than obvious. The players, the very people documented in the text, were keenly changed, and I discovered a brand new character. After the simplest bit of detective work on my part, I found that all the neighbors' children know him in one way or another, and he was in every single reference to British history that I can find in the library. There is even a Mickey Mouse cartoon that I had never before heard of, based very loosely upon this character. In all the tales of Arthur I have ever read, I have never, never before gazed upon the person of Merlin Ambrosius, the king's sorcerer and adviser. He is brand new to me. Doc, what the hell have you been up to? And good God, did you have to use your real name?